Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. And we always like to begin on the subject of health because everybody deserves to be healthier and happier. The Cleveland Clinic examined the death burden, what they call mortality, which is death burden, of modifiable behavioral risk factors. That means modifiable, things we can change. We can say yes or no to a particular item. And how that ends up causing us to die faster or slower. Obesity was the number one cause, and that included obesity. Almost always you're going to have diabetes. They also looked at hypertension and high cholesterol. And this was published in the Society of General Internal Medicine and presented at their annual meeting. So here's what it comes down to. A team of researchers from the Cleveland Clinic and New York University School of Medicine have found that obesity resulted in as much as a 47% more life years lost than tobacco and also high blood pressure. So that's serious. I've tried to share on so many occasions that there is no such thing as being overweight and healthy. It's simply not humanly possible. You may not suffer from some of the noticeable classically defined illnesses, but you're not healthy. When you're overweight, you have a greater propensity to collect toxins in the fatty tissue. You're going to be more likely to have hormone imbalances. Your heart is not growing with the weight of your body, but it still has to pump blood to even fat tissue. As a result, there's greater strain upon the heart. Your arteries are going to take a beating, especially the epithelial. And most people don't get overweight by eating organic broccoli and split peas. You get overweight by eating, more often than not, junk foods or the standard American diet, or comfort foods, which are the standard American diet, which are junk foods. And these are all pro-inflammatory. So when you're overweight, you also have what are called cytokines and tumor necrosis factor alpha. And these chemicals that are highly inflammatory. Just imagine someone coming up to you, and you're in a conversation, and you're outside. It's a nice day. It's sunny. And someone says, "How you doing?" You say, "Okay." And when they say, "How you doing?" they suddenly take a cigarette, and they hold it against your chest. And you go, "Wow. That's burning me." "Yeah. Well, you said you're doing okay, so it shouldn't bother you." Now think of it this way. Think of every time we go out and we have a hamburger, a hot dog, french fries, a cola, coffee, alcohol, marijuana, and say, "I'm feeling fine." No, you're not. That's a perceptional disorder. And if there's one disorder that Americans are absolutely addicted to, it's dysfunctional altered perception. It's much like saying, "Well, you broke my heart." "No, I dishonored your perceptions of me," which means then that the perception is what you were in love with, or the perception is what you needed, or the perception is what made you laugh. But what if that doesn't meet the reality? Then it's not a heart that's broken, it's perceptions that are broken. So when you go to the doctor and you're expecting the doctor, who you have a perception will be able to diagnose and treat the disease and do it as non-toxically and humanely as possible, and you end up dying from the chemotherapy, not the tumor. You end up committing suicide, not because you were depressed, but because of the side effects of the antidepressant. You end up being diagnosed with hyperactivity disorder, not because your brain is chemically imbalanced, but because of the caffeine that you're using and the amount of brain damage from the cell phones that you sleep with and have constantly at your head. So our perception is what killed us, because perceptions create our reality. So our reality kills us. Our belief system kills us. Because it's the belief system that lets you believe that if you're overweight, you're okay. Hey, as long as your blood pressure, you're on meds, and your blood pressure's okay, your cholesterol's high, but you got medication. Your blood sugar's high, you're diabetic, but no problem. Yeah, I got insulin. Next thing you know, your digestion's fine because you're taking a laxative. And you don't have to worry about eating bad foods because you're taking antacid. And that GERD that's causing reflux to go up back in your esophagus, not a problem because you've got another anti-GERD, the hyperacidic condition taken care of. You don't have, you know, it's perfect. I'm fine. I got a good night's sleep last night because you were taking a sleep medication, and that was not a good night's sleep. I'm feeling okay. Hey, I'm dealing with stress because you're on 37 different antidepressive medications and you're drinking a lot of alcohol. Your brain just a sponge, but I feel okay. So we live with this altered perception of okay, happy, love, health. And it's all an illusion, absolutely an illusion. I posted today on my Facebook a photograph because it so reminded me of the first Earth Day that I participated in. I had a best-selling book at the time on the environment called Clearer, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, Blueprint for New Environment. So I was invited to come down to Dallas, and I was the keynote speaker, thousands and thousands of people. And what I noticed is how everybody was eating junk food and drinking, you know, alcohol and colas, and the place was a pigsty. So I'm thinking, what exactly am I supposed to say to these people? Because there's a cognitive disconnect here. We're here to talk about the environment, and these people have brought their plastic to trash, everything that's non-disposable to try to dispose of, eating garbage. What part of my message am I going to get across? It was a real challenge. And yet I'm sure if you spoke with each one of them individually, they would say, yeah, they're pro-environment, just like you ask people. Are you pro-health? Yeah, I'm pro-health. You got to watch this. It's you can take a look at it in The Joy of Juicing, which you can watch free up on my Facebook page. I went up to Harlem, and I stood outside of two establishments. One was a Burger King and a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a McDonald's, about 125th Street on the west side of the street. And I waited, and as people came out, I walked over with a camera, and I said, hi, I'm Gary Noll, and I'm doing a documentary, and I'm just curious about what you bought and why you bought it. And then I asked him, do you know of any consequence? Every single person said, well, yeah, I'm interested in health. And here's the irony. 3 of the 7 people I interviewed listen to my show daily. So I asked, what's in the bag? And you see it. You see me saying, what's in the bag? And they open up the bag. It's all garbage. And yet they say, well, you know, I like it. So then I went down 125th Street, around 3rd Avenue, thereabouts, to a juice bar. And the first thing you notice is how much thinner the people are and how much far better educated they are about their body and health. And boy, in-depth, interesting interviews about why do you come in here to get your juice and or your raw salads. They could really articulate their commitment to health. And even if at one time they didn't have that commitment, today they didn't. How much difference it made, how they overcame illnesses. So this whole idea is, do you have a real honest perception of what it means to be overweight? Because if you adapt to being overweight, you start buying larger clothes, you get around other people who are also overweight, everybody complains and commiserates about how they're a victim of something, and therefore because they're a victim, they deserve, you know, to be able to eat whatever they want or drink what they want or smoke what they want and to deal with it. Just understand, no matter what fantasy you put in your mind to justify being overweight, the reality is you're going to kill yourself quicker. And how much quicker? Well, this says, quote, that I'm quoting exactly, found that obesity resulted in as much as a 47% more life years lost than tobacco and was right up there with high blood pressure. So all the more reason to be motivated not to be overweight and not to accept the excuse that it's okay. It's not okay. Because if you're overweight, it means you have an enormous amount of free radicals in your body. You're undergoing enormous amount of oxidative stress. That means your kidneys, your liver, your heart, your eyes, your breast, your ovaries, your brain are all at greater risk of disease. So my interest is in getting people healthy, and they just have to start with an honest look at the choices they make. Louisiana State University just came up with research results where they found that fish oil, and specifically the DHA, there's EPA and DHA, The one that protects your heart and your brain, that's the DHA. It also quenches a lot of the toxic free radicals that injure the brain and the retina of the eye. So if you want to have better vision, less likelihood of having macular degeneration and cataracts, have 1,500 to 3,000 milligrams a day of omega-3 fatty acids. But look at the label. Make sure you're getting the DHA fragment. That should be dominant in there. Also, from the University of Tennessee, published in the Journal of Nutrition, they did a case-controlled study of African-American women, and they found a lower risk of ovarian cancer among those who supplemented with selenium. That's a mineral that has very strong anti-cancer and antioxidant properties. Now, we know that African-American women have an increased risk of death from ovarian cancer, and studies suggest that they have higher levels of oxidative stress and lower levels of antioxidants than women of other groups. All the more reason that if you're an African-American woman, you have to take greater care of yourself. Make sure you're getting more fresh fruits and vegetables, more fresh-made juices, take your supplements, and make sure in your multiple supplement you're getting 200 micrograms, MCG, of selenium a day. And there were a lot of people in this study, over 1,000 people, and this was from the African-American Cancer Epidemiological Study. So let's take selenium and save our health. Also from the University of Rivera in Spain, 1 ounce of peas, chickpeas, beans, soybeans, especially lentils daily, can lower your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by 35%. That was published in the Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So what does it mean? It means there's 28.35 grams to an ounce. That means 1 ounce. And if you had 3 of those servings a day, which would be easy, that's like a cup of legumes, and split peas are great. Black-eyed peas are good. Fava beans are good. White beans, kidney beans. Black soybeans are going to give you more, 3 times more. Organic black soybeans are your highest source of protein. It's way up there around 29 grams per can. And you could use 1 can, which is a little over a cup, in a salad. That's really good. And help prevent diabetes. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you today. We're going to take a look for a little bit of time before we go to our guest. And by the way, my guest today is Professor James Forman. We're going to talk about crime and punishment in the black community and the inherent racism in America's criminal justice system. He's professor of law at Yale University's Law School and a visiting professor at Stanford Law School. He specializes in constitutional law and racial issues. And I'm going to ask him, by the way, his father was one of the founders of the Black Panther Party, the late James Forman. In any case, I'm going to ask him, why is it we've had so many blacks in power who support the criminal justice system, including Eric Holder, President of the United States? Why? I would have thought they would have opened up the prisons and said, any nonviolent criminal, any drug possession criminal, expunge their records, let them all out, clean up their records, and get them back into society. Didn't happen. They cracked down even harder. So I'm going to ask him about that. But now I just want to take you on a little tour, a historical tour, about the erosion of our health freedoms throughout the decades and the efforts to preserve them. America is a country of freedoms. Yes, we criticize it every day when they're being abridged, altered, or in some way denied, as they are now, more so than ever. This includes our freedom to choose what we eat and drink. The liberty to choose healthy or unhealthy foods is one of our sovereign rights. When was the last time you focused upon the freedoms you have to treat your body and mind in your own best interest? Examples: you have the choice to keep your mercury amalgam fillings or replace them with safe composite material. There are thousands of holistic doctors, dentists, chiropractors throughout the nation who service people who want some form of non-invasive, non-pharmacological approach to treat everything from pain to any type of emotional problem. If you want to eat only organic, locally grown produce instead of factory farm, genetically engineered foods, you have those choices. There are thousands of health food stores and supermarkets and outdoor markets selling organic fruits, vegetables, and grains. You have the freedom to be a vegan, as I am, or a vegetarian, or a meat eater. If you choose not to feed your baby with foods containing sugar and salt, there are healthier alternatives. A mother has the freedom to choose breastfeeding or infant formulas. You can choose a regular cosmetic to put on your face or your hair, to shampoo or moisturizer, or you have one that is completely devoid of those toxic and irritating chemicals. If you have a major disease such as cancer and you wish to have high-dose intravenous vitamin C infusions, there are physicians, not a lot, but there are physicians who are qualified to provide this service. If you choose to avoid feeding your children chemically laden, highly processed foods, gluten-free and unprocessed foods are readily available. Just imagine that no one forces you to drink a beverage sweetened with high fructose corn syrup or aspartame. That's a choice. If you choose the right way, you can help avoid disease, obesity, depression, or anxiety. You can also choose from numerous body-mind relaxation meditation techniques. If you have a chronic pain in your shoulder and you don't want to take steroid drugs, you have the liberty to choose acupuncture. You can also purchase filters to remove fluoride and other toxins from your tap water, and you have the option to buy fluoride-free toothpaste mouthwash. If you want to receive the truth about the efficacy and safety of vaccines, there are a limited number of resources, but they exist, where you can listen to radio or watch films or read books or articles to educate yourself about the flaws in the vaccine paradigm. So as a nation, we take many of these freedoms for granted. All the issues that I just mentioned would have been denied to us today, everything I just mentioned, if it were not for the courage and integrity of a relatively tiny number of individuals fighting on our behalf. These doctors, activists, homemakers, nutritionists, scientists, and journalists did so largely in the shadows. For every struggle they took on, there were powerful private interests, legions of lobbyists to influence legislators and the media to control the message, in the process denigrate, libel, and slander those who were simply bringing us the truth. They were marginalized, and their reputations were sullied, all because they wanted the truth. It is one of the most important, forgotten, and untold stories of the past 50 years. These are some of the big battles that we are still waging. The steady rise of iatrogenic deaths caused by conventional medicine, which, by the way, is the number one cause of death. It is not heart attack. It is not stroke. It is not diabetes. It is not cancer. It's mistakes made by the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, the medical paradigm. When was the last time you heard them discussing how they could improve it, lessen it, or reform it? Not once. How serious is it? Well, if you assume a very ultra-conservative figure, way, way low than the reality of 500,000 deaths a year, and you look back over the last 20 years, you're talking about 10 million Americans dying who didn't have to. 10 million. So when we talk about other major genocides in history, 10 million is a lot of people, yet it's never mentioned. It should be. Health risks from electromagnetic pulse emissions. Ask the average young person. Ask the average old person. You're using a cell phone. It's up to your ear. Do you know what it's doing? Do you know how many studies show that it impacts your brain, your skull, your ear, your eyes? The answer is no. I assumed it was safer. Why would they allow it on the market? How about the toxic chemicals that fall out of the sky from geoengineering? All those streams that you see, those are chemicals. And they don't just dissipate. They end up in the soil, the water, the air we breathe. Also, the new dangers from widespread nanotechnology in medicine, food, clothing, and common household products. In fact, the latest scientific study I will be dealing with in an upcoming program from a respected group of scientists show that nanomaterials that are not biodegradable and are not assimilatable were found in vaccines, all the vaccines, yet it's not on the list of ingredients or other products that are listed. So they're there, but we don't know they're there. What are they doing to us? No one knows. Threats to entire communities from gas shell hydrofracking we're fighting now. Systemic destruction of the environment, our forests, our oceans, our wetlands, the great carbon lungs of the planet, the great rainforest, the boreal forest. Also, what about the indiscriminate use of carcinogenic pesticides? The demise of the nation's pollinators and honeybee colonies collapse. The harsh reality of climate change and its impact on the entire world community. Criminalizing of any expression of dissent, any form of behavior that you are exercising nonviolently and currently within your constitutional rights has already been characterized by the Justice Department, Homeland Security, the National Intelligence Services, and the White House as potential threats and hence are considered now a domestic terrorist. Also, what if you challenge your medical paradigm or environmental actions? Once again, you fall into the purview of the police state. So when it comes down to the issues concerning our personal health, our families and communities, our pets and the planet, there are two realities. There is the official orthodox corporate reality, and then there's the real truth. Where I have been for my career is on the side of supporting through research and scholarship and debate and writings and broadcasting the real truth. So before there was Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Rachel Maddow and there were truth seekers, people who would go out of their way to try to find what was the truth of an action. How would we have known that the Vietnam War was not legitimate? How would we have known that the Maddox wasn't fired upon by North Vietnamese if it were not for those people who, inside the system, decided to tell us the truth, whether the people were ready for that truth or not? And thank goodness for people like Ralph Nader and others who told us the truth. So what I'm going to do, because I'm going to go to my guest in a few minutes, is I'm going to just give you a very brief chronology over the decades of some of the major health struggles and battles waged to preserve our health and that of the planet. And some of these fights took decades, and most are still continuing. But without these struggles, there would be only a single truth, the corporate official truth that favors money, power, oligarchy, and repressive control over the nation's laws and people. This flawed and selective reality is spoon-fed to the public by a compliant and co-opted media, not just on the right, where it would be expected, but also on the left. So imagine that for the past, let's say, 45 years, there has been only a single corporatized truth and then enforced by the federal and state governments. Then ask yourself, what would be different in the world we live in today? This is an extremely important question, and its answer is urgent for younger generations who, more often than not, take for granted the freedoms they inherited at birth and subsequently ignore the scholarship, the self-sacrifices made for the battles waged on their behalf by people they will never know. In the 1960s, there were many threats to citizens' health, including the health risks of artificial sweeteners like saccharin and cyclamates, and the benefits of natural sugars, which were not included. The start of a movement to bring awareness about the toxicity of fluoride, the environment and human health risks of nuclear power and nuclear radiation exposure, the start of the animal rights movement, the new concerns about the psychiatric drugging of children, including widely prescribing of Ritalin and other drugs with neurological problems, the popularity of infant formulas as an alternative to much healthier breast milk. Breast milk was downplayed, home delivery, midwifery was downplayed and attacked, and it was formula feeding for convenience and because they said science had mastered what the mother's breast milk had done, but without the problems. With the arrival of the 1970s, there appeared to be a concerted effort by the medical establishment and the AMA to strategically attack all alternative medicine and non-drug-based natural therapies. At this time, natural drug-free medical practices had no voice, none. I was the only radio show in the United States. Let me repeat that. I was the only radio show in this entire country that gave regular platforms to doctors and people, advocates, for alternative positions. That's a shame. There should have been thousands of such programs, because at any given hour, there were at least 5,500 other forms of media on radio alone. In time, the media would increasingly side with the pharmaceutical industry, and federal and state health agencies not only did not like someone talking about alternative treatments, but actually sicked the state medical boards on them. And I found a lot of my time spent helping individuals who had done nothing more than be victims of the medical McCarthyism, the witch hunts against any doctor, any scientist who voiced the dangers of popular drugs, products, and foods, who spoke out against DDT, saccharin, cyclamates, and who advocated new alternative therapies to treat disease, especially cancer. Benjamin Feingold, a pediatrician who found an association between food additives such as salicylates, artificial colors, and preservatives with hyperactivity and allergies. He was right, they were wrong, but they attacked him. Marshall Mandel, the founder of bioecolic medicine, and Theron Randolph, a pioneer in early environmental medicine, showing you could be impacted by the air you breathe, the couches you sit on, the particle wood at the desk that you're sitting at, the gases coming out the formaldehyde out of a carpet. It all could impact a sensitive person. They discovered that severe health conditions like multiple sclerosis and cerebral palsy are significantly complicated by environmentally induced allergens. Dr. Doris Rapp, she was the first to raise alarm about environmental toxins contributing to children's allergies. Dr. William Crook, who identified yeast associated with many illnesses. Dr. Robert Mendelson, a pioneer pediatrician who denounced invasive medical procedures and dangerous prescription drugs, including vaccines and the use of diethylspestrol during pregnancy. Dr. Robert Atkins, who promoted a nutritional approach to combating cardiovascular disease. Dr. Carl Humiston, a Harvard-trained psychiatrist who pioneered the wellness movement. All these people were attacked. Jonathan Wright for his research into the role of the B-complex to fight cancer, particularly breast cancer. And what did they do to Jonathan Wright? One morning, a SWAT team broke in his door. They could have opened it. He was open for business. No, they have to go through the door, guns drawn, pointed at a person's head, a receptionist, with the thought that if she moved, they would shoot. What did all this come to? They were looking for a preservative-free B-complex. That's it. His only crime was he got a B-complex that didn't have a preservative in it. And yet, the report was from the FDA that night, doctor arrested for illegal drugs. No, there were no illegal drugs. It was a preservative-free B-complex that he got, which was completely legal. Dr. Thomas Saws, a professor of psychiatry who was expelled from his university position at Syracuse for speaking out against the politics of psychiatric diagnosis and psychotropic drugging. Dr. John Goffman, a nuclear physicist at the University of California, Berkeley, who raised public alarm about the human risks of radiation exposure. He was the one who said to me on the air in 1975, "Gary, there is no such thing as a safe X-ray. None ever in your life. One X-ray at any time in your life will ultimately, if you live long enough, cause cancer at another end." He was an MD, PhD, and one of the co-discoverers of plutonium. He was one of the best and brightest, yet he had the courage to tell the truth. Professor Dean Burke, the biochemist and co-discoverer of biotin, and one of the co-founders of the National Cancer Institute, who spoke out against water fluoridation, finding that over 30,000 Americans died each year because of fluoride in the water. Dr. Hal Huggins, the father of holistic dentistry, who voiced concerns about the toxicity and danger of dental fillings. He was right. Every holistic dentist in America today who takes out your toxic silver fillings, which are 52% mercury, you owe that to Hal Huggins. He was nonstop harassed. Dr. Paul Rudich, who alarmed the public about the use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam military campaigns. We went on a campaign. We did 112 programs on my radio show in defense of the Vietnam vets who were coming down with strange physical illnesses that we found were linked to Agent Orange exposure. The government finally gave them a small token payment, never acknowledged that it was dangerous. But without Paul Rudishan, we wouldn't have known that. William Duffy authored the classic Sugar Blues, which outlined the history of sugar and its enormous risk to human health. There were also more than 260 doctors and scientists who were attacked, some imprisoned. James Privateria was imprisoned. Why? Because he was seeing over 300 persons with cancer. Not one complained. They all showed up at court wanting to testify how much better they were under his nutritional approach. And because he was not using current standards of practice, meaning he was not giving chemotherapy, radiation, or surgery, but rather giving nutrition, he was found guilty and went to work on a chain gang. They put him in hard labor. He was found guilty. His only crime, he wasn't using all orthodox therapy. He was using natural therapy. When I found out about it, we went on a campaign and finally got the Governor Brown's father to get him out of prison, but he had been on hard labor for a long time. There were many others. Linus Pauling, the only American scientist to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, the founder of the quantum molecular chemistry, and he discovered anti-cancer therapies in megadose vitamin C. Virginia Livingston Wheeler, Stanislaw Brzezinski, Lawrence Burton, they all had something in common. They were helping patients, but they were not doing it using orthodoxy, hence they were attacked. So this ends part one today. I'll continue part two, but just remember, every single therapy you're getting today that's alternative, including chiropractic would not exist today. It was on its deathbed when people dropped off some envelopes at my apartment, myself and Joe Lisa, which showed that there was a secret department of investigations in the headquarters of the AMA. It had been going on for 25 years to destroy chiropractic and all other alternative ways of healing. They were sued. The AMA was sued. The 12 major medical organizations in America were sued. They were found guilty. Their guilt was upheld to the Supreme Court. That should have changed the idea that we should have it in democracy, the right of the individual to select with their doctor the therapy that they want. And to this day, that is still being mocked and ridiculed. So remember, every choice you have today, every single choice when it comes to health, there was a long battle fought so you could have those rights. I just want to remind people of who came before you, the sacrifices they lived with. Many went to jail, and we don't even know their names or remember their stories. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going out to Washington, D.C. to say hello to Professor James Forman. I gave you his background earlier in the program. And it's nice to have you with us today, James.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
The general belief, and perhaps even more for most African Americans, many of whom are listening right now and who embrace the left-leaning liberal political positions, hold to the idea that the black leadership over the years was more supportive of rehabilitation and social programs and other means of dealing with higher rates of crimes in the black communities before you put anyone in jail. They did not believe in resorting just to arrests, imprisonment, and throwing away the key. But I believe that you have uncovered a different story, that in fact, during the past 4 or 5 decades, it has been African-American policymakers themselves who have largely contributed to the mass disproportional incarceration of black men and women in our current private prison industrial complex. And whether this was intentional or a blindness about the long-term consequences, I'm going to ask you to explore that in a second. Nevertheless, at one time, black leaders were largely favorable to strict, hardened criminal laws, and they felt this was for the benefit of African-American communities. However, in some ways, this might suggest that a split occurred within the African-American community between a new emerging educated class, and then the rest of the African-American community. So please take your time and share more about this relatively unknown history, which includes figures like Marion Barry Brown, black church leaders, even Obama's former Attorney General Eric Holder, or even Obama himself. Why arrests and imprisonment trumped public service, trumped education, and trumped other social means that would not necessarily result in either any prison term, and particularly for less severe crimes that today have been made to seem as if you're arrested for something today, even if you're arrested for resisting arrest, but there was no cause for you to be arrested to begin with, that suddenly throws you in jail. And then what you are proposing is that these policy makers act with good intentions, yet they've added fuel to the very fire they were trying to extinguish. So please go into detail on this. The forum is yours.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me. So I think I should start by saying how I got interested in this project. So I was a public defender in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s, and I had taken the job because I saw the job of fighting against mass incarceration. We didn't have that term at the time, but we knew that one in three young black men was under criminal justice supervision. And what I took the job because I saw it as a civil rights work of my generation. My parents were both in SNCC. My dad was the executive secretary of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I had all kinds of opportunities that had been made possible by the work of that generation of freedom fighters and of civil rights heroes. And yet, and still, we saw this growing prison population that was really doing great damage to the African-American community. So I go into the job as a public defender in Washington, D.C., and one of my first clients was a young man named Brandon. He was 15 years old. He was charged with possession of a gun, possession of small amount of marijuana, about $15, $20 worth. And he had pled guilty, and he was facing sentencing. Brandon was African-American. Almost all my clients in D.C. were. And the prosecutor is African-American in this case, and she's asking for him to be locked up. She wants to send him to Oak Hill, a juvenile prison, which was a terrible place, like a lot of our juvenile prisons, fights, barbed wires, concrete cells. I mean, it was a prison. They called it a juvenile facility, but you should think of it as a prison. And the judge had to make the decision. And I had presented material about Brandon. It was his first arrest. He had teachers and counselors who spoke well of him. But it was a serious crime, a serious offense. And at the time, gun violence in the city was very, very high. And the judge himself, African-American, kind of leaned back, and then he looked forward at Brandon, and he said, "Son, Mr. Foreman has been telling me that you have had a difficult life and that you deserve a second chance." And he said, "Son, I don't deny that, but let me tell you what difficult was." And then the judge starts to talk about Jim Crow. He starts to talk about segregation. And he said, "Son, here's the thing. People marched and fought and died for you to be free. Dr. King died for you to have opportunities that other generations could not have imagined. And he did not die for you to be out there running and thugging and gunning and carrying on and carrying drugs and embarrassing your community and your family. So you might turn your life around one day, and I hope that you do. I hope Mr. Foreman is right. But right now, actions have consequences, and your consequence is to go to Oak Hill." And he locked him up. And as I reflected on that, I went back to see him, and the cell behind the courtroom was all African-American young men like him, and there were other cells with African-American girls, but I was talking to a boy, a young man at the time. And as I thought about that, and I thought about that the city council that had written the gun laws and written the drug laws was a majority African-American city council, the police force was majority African-American and had an African-American police chief. And I realized that there was a story that needed to be told, because this judge was not alone. He was not the only one, and this wasn't the only case like it. And so I felt like I needed to write something to get back into this history, starting in the 1960s and 1970s, and try to figure out how it is that an African-American community in D.C. and African-American actors in other parts of the criminal justice system around the country ended up embracing some of these tough-on-crime measures, which have been so damaging to the community. Now, you said in your, intro, you kind of framed it as, were they kind of rejecting rehabilitation and other things. And I think it's complicated because, and of course, there's no monolith, right? There's a range of people that I write about, and people have different points of view. And I find some people, yes, that do reject, you know, rehabilitation and say, listen, these children are just lost. But I don't think that's true for everybody. A lot of the people that I write about, a lot of people I encountered in the historical record and that I interviewed in some cases, they say that they support education, job training, housing, schools. They want a Marshall Plan, or they still want a Marshall Plan for urban America, a massive investment in our inner city and African-American communities. So it's not that they reject those ideas. They want them, but they also want police and prosecutors and prisons. And now here's where the story of institutional racism and systemic racism and political constraints comes into play. The African-American Leaders and Act that I write about, they couldn't get those other things. They didn't have enough political power, right? We did not control Congress. And so they could get more police and more prosecutors, but they couldn't get the Marshall Plan for urban America. And that's really kind of the tragedy of the book, because in some senses, in a number of instances, they wanted so much more. I write in the book that they had this all-of-the-above strategy. They wanted police, prosecutors, prisons, and jobs, and schools, and housing, but they got one of the above. And the one of the above they got was law enforcement.
Okay.
The other part of the story that I think is important to really flesh out is there's also a class component to this, and you hinted at this in your introduction. So we have a group of elected officials that is overwhelmingly, really exclusively college educated. Many of them have gone to, you know, graduate and professional schools. And these folks come into power, come into office in the 1970s, right? There's an 800% increase in African-American elected officials in the 1970s from before, you know, in the Jim Crow years. However, the people that are going to prison, and in many respects, the people that are being policed most aggressively, are not those same individuals. They are overwhelmingly, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly poor, uneducated or poorly educated, have been underserved by our school systems. Many have dropped out or been kicked out of school. They're trapped in what we used to call ghettos, but they're trapped in urban communities that where jobs have left or have been sucked out. And so you do have a divide. There is a difference. So when we know this from the numbers, so I'll just give you one. If you are an African-American man born in the 1960s, and this would probably be true for women as well, but the statistics that we have are, you know, are for men, there's a 10, and you have dropped out of high school, you are 10 times more likely to be incarcerated at some point in your life than if you're an African-American man who's attended college. So what that means is that the people that are making the decisions don't fully feel that pain of having been incarcerated. And it's actually, I think, you know, one of the things, I don't write about this in the book specifically, but as I've been writing since, and I've, you know, written op-eds and I've been giving speeches, one of the big arguments that I've been making is that what has to change in the criminal justice reform community, you know, people that are pushing for a less harsh criminal justice system. In the past, in the 90s and last decade, it was led by elites, by really the same people that, you know, of the same class, educational and economic class, as those who built the system. But what's going to have to change is we're going to have to put people and allow space for people who are incarcerated, who have been incarcerated, or who have criminal convictions, to play leadership roles in pushing back. You know, Glenn Martin, the founder of Just Leadership USA, says you know, those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And I think that's right, but historically we have kept those voices out, in part because a lot of advocates have said, well, people with a criminal record, they're too stigmatized. No one's really going to listen to them. You know, once you say, oh, I got a conviction for drugs or burglary or robbery, whatever it is, that lawmakers or the general public will just dismiss you. But, of course, the problem is that just reinforces the stigma because people never get used to hearing from somebody who does have that as part of their background. We have to normalize it. We have to make it, not normalize people going to prison, that shouldn't become normal, but we have to make it normal that somebody who has been to prison or who has been convicted, whether or not they've been to prison, is somebody who is allowed to, indeed invited to, encouraged to, raised up as a voice on these questions of criminal justice reform. And once you start doing that, I've spoken to advocates, they say that really changes the conversation. A friend of mine, a guy named David Singleton, he runs the Ohio Justice Policy Center. They do a lot of amazing anti-incarceration criminal justice work out in Ohio. And he says that the most powerful person he can bring to a meeting with a legislator in Ohio who's not sympathetic to their case, the most powerful spokesperson is somebody on his staff, and he's got a number of folks like this, who have been incarcerated. Because there's so many myths, there's so many assumptions, there's so many lies that people have absorbed in this American culture about what it means to have been incarcerated. Then they're confronted with somebody who's thoughtful and articulate and well-read, and more than that, has that direct experience, can say, you know, they might tell you that double selling and triple selling is okay, but let me tell you what it's actually like to live in that space. They might tell you that it's okay to tear out the education programs, but let me tell you what it's like to go day to day with no access to books and no functioning law library. So, you know, that's an example of the kind of thing that would be a response to some of the class kind of bias that I described in the book.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You've charged former Attorney General Eric Holder as a prominent force behind the increase in crime rates during his legal career, such as his Operation Ceasefire. Could you explain this further and the various policies under Obama and earlier under Holder that supported and contributed to the rise of African-American incarceration and even crimes in African-American communities because of their actions?
Absolutely. And I should start by saying that I think Eric Holder has done a tremendous amount of good in his career, and he's doing a lot of good right now, both as Attorney General and steps that he took to push back against some of kind of the excesses of the system. And I think he's doing a lot of good now on voting rights and other issues as he goes off into, you know, and now he's in private practice, but he's still doing a lot of kind of public work. So I think and he's done historically in his life a lot of great work around juvenile justice reform. I've seen some of it kind of up close and personal. So he has to be seen in the full balance, right, of his career. And I think he deserves a lot of the honors and accolades that he's been getting. But then he's also an important window into African-American attitudes and the attitudes of African-American leaders in the 1990s, right? So Eric Holder becomes the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia in the early 1990s at the very tail end of the crack era. The homicide rate had tripled in Washington, D.C. in these years. People were calling it the Prince George's, which right outside of D.C., Prince George's County, NAACP. The head called crack the worst thing to hit us since slavery. And that was a common refrain at the time, right? So addiction is everywhere. Crime is rising. Eric Holder comes in as a U.S. attorney, and he says we have to launch a major crackdown on guns. And he gives a speech where he says, listen, the people of Washington, D.C. today are no freer than were the people of Selma, Alabama in 1955. What was keeping them down was Jim Crow. What was keeping us down and locked inside is crime and violence. So this is a crisis that he's trying to respond to, and it was a real crisis. What he chooses to do in response, I argue in the book, was a style of policing that has proved incredibly damaging to black communities. So he launches something called Operation Ceasefire. And there are lots of Operation Ceasefires all around the country, and they have all different, it's a very common name. It's still a name used today, and they have different components. What this one was about was the idea that we're going to stop people for any traffic violation we can find. And you know it's been said by Supreme Court justices and lots of police, you know, give me 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 60 following anybody, and I'll find a traffic violation. So we're going to find, because the traffic code and regulation is very, very complicated and elaborate. So we're going to stop you if we can find a traffic violation. It might be your tinted windows are too dark. It might be broken taillight. It might be expired registration. It might be not stopping at a stop sign. It might be stopping too long at a stop sign. You name it. But the reason for these stops was not because they were worried about traffic safety. And it wasn't to raise money for the local municipal coffers, as we saw in Ferguson, Missouri, and in other places where they were giving people tickets just to support the local government. They had a different reason. Their reason was that Holder's reason and the police force's reason was they wanted to get inside those cars because they wanted to search cars and search for guns. So they pull people over, they go up. They look, by just pulling you over, they can look inside, right? The officer's allowed to look inside the car as they're approaching, and they're trained on how to do that. And then if they have any reason, any suspicion, it doesn't have to be, you know, a legal basis, but if they have enough reason in their own head and they think, you know what, I want to search this car, they can ask. And overwhelmingly, over 90% of people who ask agree. For lots of reasons. People don't feel like they can say no. They think if they say no, the police are going to do it anyway, etc. The result of this, when you do this across a city, and they didn't do it everywhere in the city, they left out the one part of the city where most of the D.C.'s white citizens live. They said that's not going to be part of this operation. If you do that across a city, across a neighborhood, across a community, you're going to find some guns for sure, and they did, but you're also going to find a lot of other small stuff that itself is not a big problem, but gets swept up. And the evidence suggests that most racial disparity, you know, we talk about racial disparities in traffic stops, driving while black, and all of that. The new research shows that most of it is driven by this kind of stop, which is called a pretext stop, right? Because you're using the tinted windows as a pretext for your real goal, which is to look for guns or drugs. Most racial disparities are driven by that. The police, it turns out, are fairly not racially neutral when stopping people, for example, for speeding. There's a little bit of disparity there, but it's pretty fair. But this, that is to say, when they're actually trying to get them for speeding. But when they're doing these pretext investigatory stops, that drives overwhelmingly the racial disparities that are now well documented. And I saw it,
James,
in my own practice.
James, we're going to have to bring you back for a full hour because we're just getting into this now, and you have so much to share. So I hope that you'll come back for a full hour. We'll have you on the Progressive Commentary Hour where we can go into greater depth on this. You're opening our minds to a lot that most people don't think about. And hopefully they'll have a chance to read the book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And if you live in New York City, Professor Foreman will be speaking at New York University Law School tomorrow at 12:30 and Thursday at John Jay Criminal College at 5 p.m. Professor James Foreman, thank you for being on today. And for all of you listening, thank you. Stay tuned for Utrecht Lead right now.